Okay, good afternoon. So today we're going to talk about some more specific things. In particular, we're going to talk a bit about 64-bit x86 assembly, things that you may have not been taught in 2150 or may not remember from 2150, and go a little bit into C. But first, some logistics stuff. So there were quizzes. Hopefully you found them. I know from the number of submissions that not everyone in the class found them. You should do that in the future. It's a good idea. The quizzes have a place for you to provide comments, and we will in fact have TAs look at the comments for all questions which are auto-graded as incorrect, and we may give you credit if your comments suggest you actually knew what was going on, even though your answer didn't match what we expected. The question order is randomized. So if your comment refers to an option letter, or you ask me about a quiz question referring to a question number and an option letter, I do not know which option or question you're talking about. They're different for everyone. This is to keep things fair, to make sure that people don't just text A, B, C, D to each other and expect that to work. But that means you should keep that in mind when you're asking us about the quizzes or writing comments. There's a place on Colab to provide anonymous feedback, which is really anonymous and which I really do read. And one complaint was that one of our quiz questions seemed a bit unclear. We had a question where we asked about running task A, B, and C, and we said one of the options was you speed up A and run it in parallel with B and C. And it wasn't clear whether we meant that we speed up A and run B and C still serially, but at the same time as A, or they are all in parallel all at the same time. That wasn't clear. I should have written the question differently, and I agree, which is why there are two answers listed as correct on the quiz. So one for both interpretations. And there were some complaints about this question, saying that the lecture slides did not prepare us to properly answer that question. And I understand that the question was a little more than applying the formula from the lecture slide, and maybe we shouldn't have had it just because of how much time we spent on that topic, but I think it's reasonable to expect you to figure that out. The intended idea was that you would draw a picture similar to the ones I showed in lecture to illustrate the sort of diminishing returns concept to figure out how long things would take. Not that you would apply the formula, because it's not obvious what you put in the speed up slot in the formula. There's no real idea from several of the options what that would be. Instead, the sort of idea is to draw this picture like this and figure out where the beginning and end of time would be for the different ways of executing the tasks. Also, complaints about the endianness question. Observing that, you know, didn't know whether I meant bottom up or top down. I think the question is fair because if I say A is followed by B in an array, you would be very surprised if A was at index 100 and B was at index 99. Probably wouldn't like me if I did that. So I think the question was clear, but this does bring up that I didn't tell you something when I showed you a picture of memory where I had the addresses increasing as you go up. This is usually how our textbook and we will draw memory in this course. This may or may not match your intuition, so just get used to it. That usually we'll draw larger addresses higher on the page. I will try to always label such pictures so you don't need to guess, but just expect that. Even though this direction seems wrong to some people intuitively. So any questions about this? Some people just don't like the idea of all these little quizzes. Aren't you treating us like high school students? And I'm very sympathetic to the idea of just giving you all the course material and letting you work out what a good schedule for you is to figure out the material, but it doesn't really work to have people actually succeed in the course. I don't believe that most students would prep for lectures if we didn't have some sort of forcing function like this pre-quiz. I don't think most students would really review the material before we had an exam if we didn't have some forcing function like the post-quiz. That's the reason they're there. yes, I think it would be nice if I believed I could just give you the whole semester and just test you at the end, or maybe not at all, and assume you'd actually learn the material, but I don't think that's what happens. So continuing to talk about the quiz, there is one question on C versus C++, which was the most missed question by a lot. And I used the word standards conformant, which I should have mentioned and didn't. I thought it made the question clearer, but it probably really didn't. It probably made it less ambiguous, but not clearer. So there's a standard written by some international standards body, which defines what C and C++ are. This is why there are multiple C and C++ compilers out there, and they all agree on what to do. And the compilers may accept more than what the standard allows, but the standard sort of sets the baseline for what C and C++ are. And on the slide, I mentioned that C is almost a subset of C++. So this means that a lot of C is valid C++, but there is some C that is not valid C++. And obviously, there's a lot of C++ that is not valid C. And I didn't go through any examples of where the differences are. I think I should do that today. So here's an example of something which is valid C and not valid C++. And the problem here is that malloc returns a void star, which is a different kind of pointer than a care star. In C++, you have to use a cast like this to convert between the two. In C, you can just use a void star as any other kind of pointer, and it will convert without a cast for you. Another example, which is a little more silly, is that in C, you can name a variable class. Class is not a special thing in C. In C++, that's illegal, because class is a keyword. It's special everywhere. Any questions about these examples? So there was another complaint that people looked at the quizzes and thought, I didn't remember that being in the lectures or the reading. I think it was. It wasn't clear from the feedback which quiz they were referring to. But I gather there was some confusion about the reading for this week, which I should have gone over last lecture because you could misread it. So some people probably thought it was just chapter one, and I listed some figures. The figures were meant to be reading. They're sort of review of assembly you mostly know, but to catch up on details if you didn't have 64-bit version of 2150. So that was figures 3.2, 3.3, and 3.28, which are in chapter three, but I didn't want you to read actual parts of chapter three because that would be a waste of time. Okay, so with things about the quiz and anonymous feedback on over, any non-anonymous feedback, comments, questions? Yes?
I had a question about the one where exactly where the fourth argument went in the stack. Why does it go to ECX and not R? Wait, sorry, let me look again.
So the answer was why is the answer ECX and not RCX?
Yeah.
So ECX and RCX, so ECX is a part of the RCX register. So if RCX was a choice, I probably would have to accept it. But it deliberately wasn't, precisely because of that confusion.
Oh.
I used ECX as the choice because it's a 32-bit argument.
Oh.
So you're logically going to set the 32-bit register. But it's the same as setting the 64-bit one, so it wouldn't matter. Okay. And a final logistical issue, there are office hours. They are and will be posted on the website. And there's also a Piazza. You probably should be familiar with both of these. Yes?
So for that last question, if it says 64-bit, like x86, you can still use the 32-bit register?
Yes, just like you can use the 16-bit registers in 32-bit x86. And they're just subsets. The 32-bit registers are just a part of the 64, like the 16-bit are a part of the 32-bit ones. And one of the figures that was assigned as reading in the textbook gives you the diagram of how they're nested. Okay, so to start out, I'm going to look at sort of how we go from C to assembly to machine code, that sort of pipeline, which you've seen before in 2150. So you do something where you take a C file and you compile it into assembly. And that assembly file gets assembled into what was known as an object file. And somehow, that object file is not ready to be run yet, so we need to do some sort of linking stage to turn it into an executable. And in particular, one of the things the linking stage does is that in our C file, we might refer to some function like printf. Printf is basically the C equivalent of cout. We'll talk about it probably next time. And we don't have a definition of printf in this main.c, which means we're not going to have a definition in main.s, which means we're not going to have a definition in main.o. But when we have this executable, printf works. So something had to happen. And that means that, usually unbeknownst to us, our linker has chosen to give us an extra file and put it as part of our application. So some standard io.o object file got linked in along with main.o, so we have an implementation of printf, so our program works. Now, you've probably seen either of these individual steps, but usually when you compile programs, you don't do the command line for doing one step at a time. You don't produce an assembly file and then turn that into an object file. You often just say, I have a C file and I want to produce an executable. And what that's actually doing is it's doing all these steps with temporary files that you just don't see. But all these steps happen every time. It's just that sometimes the compiler creates the files for you in a temporary directory and gets rid of it when they're done. So usually we will end up using these shorthands rather than like doing every step, but it's all still happening behind the scenes. And linking is probably kind of a mysterious thing, so I'd like to talk more about what's actually in the assembly and the object files and the executable. You know, what is the actual sort of contents of those files? And we'll go through this simple example of our hello world program, this time using puts, another standard IO function for just outputting a string. And let's look at what the contents of each of the next steps of this pipeline are to get this hello.c to hello.exe, some executable that we can actually run. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to compile it. So we're going to convert this hello.c to an assembly file. And in our assembly file, we still have our main with the name main, and we have the assembly code for main, and we also have a data part, which is marked with this data marker, where we have the string. And the assembly code refers to the string by its label, and we have a label for main. So we still have names in the assembly file, and it still is kind of readable. So the next step is going to be to convert this to an object file. And the most straightforward thing we need to do is we need to take this assembly code here and convert it to machine code. So that's going to be our first step. We're going to take this part marked text, this assembly code, and convert it to its equivalent machine code, which I'm not expecting you to understand that machine code ever in this course, but you can take my word for it that this is machine code for this assembly code. So what else do we need in the object file? So I'm not done yet. What other things from the assembly file am I missing? Yes? Okay, so you're thinking that I'm missing standard io.h. And to a first approximation, that standard io.h is not actually going to put anything in our assembly file. That's probably not quite true, but it's pretty close to true. That's a bit weird, but that's usually how it works. So what's in the standard io.h file? What would people imagine is something that's in standard io.h? Yes?
Like definitions of cout and cin and puts, I guess, probably here.
Yeah, so you say definitions. So it's more likely to be just declarations. So we could have a definition of puts, that's possible, but most likely it's just a declaration of puts. So if it's just a declaration, there's not going to be any function body, there's not going to be any code to put in the assembly file. If the H file contained a definition, then yes, we would expect this assembly file to have a little extra for the contents of the .h file. Okay. So I was wondering, let's assume this assembly file is complete. What stuff from the assembly file are we missing from this object file? So we have the machine code for the assembly. What else do we need to put in there?
Like
Yes.
The call to the Foots method?
The
call to the Foots method?
So we need to do something to make calling puts work. And just having assembly that calls it, because a machine code that is designed to call it won't work. So that's one thing, and we'll get to that in a bit. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you need a separate assembly file, a separate .o file for puts, right? And then you link them?
Yeah, so that's going to happen later, though. In the object file, we're not going to have the implementation of puts. But we need to know that we need it. We don't have that information here yet. We don't have anything about puts. So that's going to be needed. Anything else? There's an easy one. Yeah? Yeah, so we probably want to put this string somewhere. Probably should be in the object file. So we're going to copy that in there. So we'll have a text segment, that's the code. We're going to have a data segment with data like the constant string. That's going to be part of the object file. So in addition, we're going to need to deal with the call to puts. So, for example, this here is the subtract instruction, but we also have some other things. So, this pink part here, which is kind of hard to see, that's where the address of puts goes. And right now, we have a bunch of zeros. So, the way object files typically work is we have placeholders for addresses we don't know where they're going to end up in the final executable yet. In this object file, since we haven't linked everything in, we don't even know where this string is going to end up. So we also have a placeholder for the string here. There's a place, this is all zeros. We need to replace that with the actual address the string is going to have. And as people observe, we probably need some information to tell the linker that it's going to do that. If the linker just gets this file, there's no way it's going to fill those zeros in with the correct values. So we have what are called relocations. They move an address from this placeholder of all zeros to the actual location that this string and puts end up in the memory in the final executable. And we can't fill that in yet in the object file because we don't know what else is going to be in memory and therefore where anything will end up in memory. So we're going to write in the object file after the code and the data, we're going to write a list of changes we need to make to the code depending on where we put things. So our first note here says 6 bytes in to our code, I want you to replace those 4 bytes there with the address that the data segment ends up at in memory, wherever the final memory address if that's going to be. And 10 bytes in, I want you to replace this with the address that puts ends up in memory. And by saying puts here, we've given enough information to know that, oh, we need to include the .o file that contains the definition of puts. Because we see here, I need the address of puts, which means I need the code for puts. So the linker's job here is going to be to take this text and data along with the text and data from the other object file, figure out where it is in memory, and then fill in these holes. Then it's going to go through this list of relocations and take the location it computed for everything and replace the zeros with that final location. So any questions about how this procedure looks? So there's one thing that I'm missing from this object file that we actually need to produce our final executable. So any ideas about what information from this assembly file I haven't put in the object file that we probably need? So one thing to think about is how are we going to start this program? What are we going to do when the program starts? Yeah?
Run main.
And we haven't actually written down in this assembly object file where main is. And we need to have that information. So that's another thing that's going to be in the object file. And that information is going to be called a symbol table. So it's going to tell us where functions and variables are in this object file. So when we need to know about where main is to produce an executable, we know that address Yeah, because some other object file might refer to it, or the linker might need to know it to set our starting address. So given this object file, the linker's going to linker and the compiler are going to link in the thing which implements puts, so that standard IO of H, hypothetically, where puts is implemented. And it's going to produce our executable. And our executable is going to be much simpler than this object file. We're going to not have all this stuff about relocations and different segments. We're basically going to just have a big bunch of binary, which is our machine code. And we're going to concatenate the machine code from all our object files together, and a big bunch of data, which is our data segments. So we're going to take the data segment from hello and the data segment from standard IO, concatenate them together. And this is basically what's in the executable. There's a little extra that actually goes on. There's some metadata. But basically, we just have this the bytes of code and the bytes of data. And this is ready to just load into memory. Yes?
So is there a difference between the .exe file and .out file?
There's a big difference here. So one thing is that we don't have the same structure here. We don't have as explicitly marked segments. We basically have something that we can just copy into memory and start running. And we've already taken care of, as part of that, these relocations. So this placeholder of zeros here got replaced with the actual address that this string has.
No, I mean .out file.
.out, okay. So .out files are a Windows name for .o files. I answered the wrong question. Yeah. So they're the same as .o files, and at the level we're going, they work the same on Linux and Windows. They're different at a lower level, but we're not going into that much detail. So other questions? Yeah.
So the executable, does it also have a symbol table?
I'm giving you an example of what is called static linking, where all the linking occurs before we produce the executable. For real executables, we actually end up doing some linking, some of this replacement of placeholders at runtime. Not always, but sometimes. So in that case, you'll have a symbol table. If you're statically linking, you might have a symbol table, but it's not necessary. It doesn't. It might be there just for debugging, for example. Yes.
So it's like what you're just talking about. Like if you have virtual method tables, those might be runtime.
This is not what I'm referring to.
Okay.
So virtual method tables will need to be, even if it's statically linked, they might not have names. They'll probably just be a list of pointers. Not a case where the linker will need to do anything. We'll just copy that list of pointers from here, from the executable into memory. There's no actual extra work to do. Other questions? Okay, so we have this blob of executable, of machine code and data, that's we're just ready to load into memory. And our linker has decided where it's going to end up in memory. And it needed to know that because we replaced some fixed addresses in here with memory addresses. And there's other things that are going to happen when we load an application into memory. And typically, you're going to see basically the same memory layout for every application on a particular system. This is the conventional layout on 64-bit Linux on the machines we'll be using most of this semester. And the convention there is that our code and data start at address 400,000 hex. That's just a decision they've made. It's arbitrary. That's just the address they've decided. And there's some other things that we need to set up to start writing an executable. So one of them is we need to have a stack. We expect to have a stack, and that's going to be part of loading the executable, is allocating the space for the stack and setting the stack pointer to point to it. And on Linux, the stack is conventionally at some address that starts hex 7F. I didn't tell you the rest because that actually varies. But as part of loading the executable, we're going to copy the executable into memory at this address here, and then set up the stack and the stack pointer. We're also going to initialize the heap, which is where things like malloc and new will put memory. And that heap will grow as our application runs, just like our stack will grow as our application runs. So one thing to keep in mind about the stack, which I think you've seen before but bears repeating, is the stack grows towards lower addresses on x86. There is no sort of rhyme or reason for this. They just had to make a choice, and their decision was to make the stack grow to lower addresses. As a consequence, the heap here is going to grow up towards the stack. And the idea is basically that you can keep growing the heap and growing the stack until you run out of addresses. That's the logic of having them grow in opposite directions, but the choice of having the stack grow towards lower addresses is just arbitrary, but you need to remember it because it comes up all the time. And because x86 has instructions that manipulate the stack like push and pop, there's no way we're changing it. And on the stack, you know, we have the usual things we expect on the stack. So the stack is where our local variables go, where anything that we allocate per function, things that need to work in recursive calls go. It's where we put save registers temporarily and all our temporary storage for functions, where our return addresses go when we call functions, and some of our arguments go. Not all of them, but some of them. I'll go into that later. The calling convention on 64-bit, if you're not familiar, uses registers more than the 32-bit one. So you might notice I have these holes here. So everyone here has seen segfaults, and accessing one of these holes is a way to get a segfault. So every program on your system has this basically the same memory layout, even though they're conceptually different programs running on the same computer, and you have these holes in your memory. And these holes are just inaccessible. If you try to access them, you get a segfault. We'll talk much later in the semester about how this works. But basically, the operating system gets to decide what memory addresses work for you and how they map to real physical memory. It can't be the case that you have physical memory going all the way up to these addresses, because 0x7f and, you know, that and 14 hex zeros is like several quadrillion bytes, which you probably don't have on your computer. So you can't really have that much memory. And you don't. So these holes here are actually not allocated real memory, and if you try to access them, you'll get an error. And it's going to be the case that every program is going to have this consistent image of how memory works, including that they can load at the same address. And we'll talk about the mechanism the processor supports to allow us to have multiple programs running which all think they own this address. So we can just produce executables and not need to decide LS gets this address, this range of addresses, and GCC gets this range, and need to make some decision in order to make everything work, or need to do a lot of linking when we load an executable. So instead, we have some processor support to let us give executables the illusion that they have whatever memory addresses the OS decides to give them, even if they're running at the same time as something else, which thinks it's using the same memory address. They'll be independent of each other. So questions about this? Yeah?
I thought you said that the stack and the heap grow towards each other and there's no space between them.
Yeah.
That's a hole between them, then how does that?
So the idea is that if you had enough memory, which you won't on 64-bit, but could on 32-bit, and you kept allocating more stack and heap space, they'd eventually reach. But there's a hole in between them which can shrink as you allocate more space. So if you call malloc a bunch of times, this heap will grow slightly. And if you call it enough on a 32-bit system, it will eventually grow to touch the stack, basically. Yeah?
So the hole just has a minimum size depending on the system, or?
Basically, yes. Or has a maximum size, and yeah. And the minimum size is arguably zero. Probably not actually zero, just because they like making it debuggable. And it's not very debuggable if your stack and heap overlap. But it's could theoretically be zero. Other questions? Okay, so this is our review of how programs work. And the other topic I promised is x86-64. And I'm talking about this now because the lab that starts on tomorrow, and it's accompanying homework, requires you to read x86-64 assembly, which some of you are familiar with, maybe from 2150. But there's some things which might be surprising. In particular, we'll be using AT&T syntax. And you're probably used to Intel syntax. So let's start by going over what AT&T syntax looks like. So here's a move from a constant to memory instruction. In AT&T syntax, move Q, $42, parentheses RBX. In Intel syntax, it's this move keyword pointer, brackets RBX 42. But the effect here is the same of these two assembly snippets. And this illustrates sort of most of the key things you need to know about AT&T assembly. So first, in AT&T syntax assembly, the destination is always last. It's always last. So the value being modified here is whatever this parentheses RBX means. It is not the 42. Parentheses always represent a value in memory using a register as an address. So this parentheses around the RBX means we're not writing to RBX, we're using RBX as a memory address and writing to that memory address. So we have $42. There is a dollar sign in front of constants, like the number 42. This is decimal 42. If you don't put a dollar sign, it can mean something different. Registers always start with a percent sign. So if you ever see percent sign something, that's some sort of register, even if you don't know what it is. And if you don't put a percent sign in front of it, it's not a register, it's a label. We have this Q here, which indicates the length. So Q means, like quad word in Intel syntax, means 8 bytes. There's also L for 4 bytes, W for 2, B for 1. You don't need to memorize this. There's a table in your textbook. In this case, we need to have the Q because we're writing to a memory location. And without the Q, we have no idea how big that memory location is. If you're writing to a register, we wouldn't need the queue because it would be implied how big a thing we were writing from the size of the register. So any questions about any of the things here? Okay, so this is the simple syntax for something in memory, but there's the highly ugly syntax that you saw in the quiz. And this is the more general syntax. So as you probably remember from 2150, x86 supports specifying two registers, and one of which is scaled. I'm adding a displacement to specify a memory address. And this is supported in the AT&T syntax assembly, but it looks rather different. So we have a displacement, a constant offset from a register for a memory address. And that comes in front of the parentheses. Yes, it is used to compute the address, even though it's outside the parentheses. It's just the convention that AT&T syntax has chosen. We have our usual base register, which appears as the first register in the list. When we have two registers specified, this is the one which is not scaled. We have our index register and its scale factor. So in this case, it's multiplied by 4. And that appears as the second thing, followed by a comma and the scale. And this is just like plus RCX times 4 in Intel syntax. So there's a table in the textbook to remind you, but you should get used to this because we'll probably be seeing it a bunch in this class. Not too much, because the subset of x86 we'll deal with for implementing our processor will not support this complicated of a way of specifying a memory location, which you should be happy about because you won't have to implement it. Yeah?
Do we need to know specifically the differences between AT&T and Intel, or do we just need to know?
You should be able to read AT&T syntax. Yeah. We will not ask you, we will be just be using AT&T syntax in this class, and that's why I'm teaching you about it. I will not ask you to write Intel syntax ever. Okay, so in addition to this three operand form plus displacement, you can also take shortcuts. So if you just have a displacement and a parentheses value, that's base plus displacement. So you can omit the last two things. If you have just a register and a scale, that's register times scale plus displacement. So you can get one of the things, or you can have them all. So all these forms are supported, but you can always use the full one with blank spaces, but you'll commonly see these in disassembly or handwritten assembly code. Yeah?
The scale always has to be like a power of 2, right?
The scale has to be 1, 2, 4, or 8. Other questions? Okay, so you have all the rules, basically, besides one we'll get to. But there's something which is technically covered by the rules I gave you, but is very confusing, and that's how subtract works. So Intel syntax makes more sense for subtract. Subtract, the order of the operands is different, but the subtraction works the same otherwise as Intel syntax, so it's in the wrong order. I am sorry about this. We will generally have a reminder at the front page of exams about this because this is not something we want you to get confused about, but it's going to come. So basically, the destination is last, like, and the order of the subtraction is wrong because that's how the subtract instruction works on x86. It's intended to use Intel syntax. The reason AT&T syntax works the way it does is because it was designed with a different processor in mind, sort of a generic assembly syntax, which has been adapted to lots of architectures. And we're using it because it's conventional on Unix, which didn't start on x86. And that's why things are broken like this. But you just need to be aware that, yeah, the order doesn't make sense. I'm sorry. So other questions? So I mentioned that constants require a dollar sign. And you might wonder, well, what happens if I don't use a dollar sign? Is that going to be an error? And the answer is often no. But it doesn't mean it's the same thing. So here, we just have the value 0x1000. And that's not a constant. That's an address. So one way you can think about this is that just like you can omit registers from the parentheses, comma, comma thing, you can omit the whole parentheses thing and just put an address in there. That makes it easier. Otherwise, you just remember the rule that if you don't have a dollar sign, it's an address. So this takes a value at an address and adds it to a register. This takes a constant from the instruction and adds it to a register. You know, this hopefully won't come up much, but I bring it up because it's very confusing if you think you're trying to add a constant and you get a seg fault instead. Okay. Questions about this? Okay. So I alluded to earlier that in 64-bit x86, we don't pass all the registers on the stack like you might be used to in 32-bit. So the calling convention, which there was a figure in your textbook, which was part of the reading, is that there are six arguments where arguments go. So it's RDI, then RSI, then RDX, and so on. I absolutely do not want you to memorize this. There's a table in your textbook. It'll tell you if you need to know. This is not worth memorizing. And generally, we specify these 64-bit registers, but if it's a smaller argument, we'll use the corresponding smaller register. So if it's a 32-bit argument, we'll use EDI instead of RDI, and so on. And any arguments beyond the sixth argument, which is not very common but happens, are going to end up on the stack. And just like you're used to with 32-bit, if you that's what you're used to, the return value goes in RAX, which is the same thing as EAX, and we'll use a smaller version if it's a smaller return value, and so on. So any questions about the calling convention? Things I'm missing? Yeah?
What would happen if you were to put two IG of a value into a register that
is
too small to hold it?
It's, there will, if you like try to put a large value in EDI,
sure.
So if you try, there's, so if you, any instruction that you think might do that, won't. So either if you try to like put a 64-bit constant in the EDI, that's not a legal instruction, and your assembler will say, sorry, I can't turn that into machine code for you. Or if you use an instruction which moves a value, say, from a register to a register, the only legal ones are going to take a 32-bit register, which might be part of a 64-bit register, and move it to EDI.
Okay.
So this gives us our usual calling sequence. When you read assembly, you should expect to see something where it might be a little less clear than this, where we move some values to these registers and then call a function. And I'm pointing this out partly because this will actually help you do the lab, I promise. It's in the home, which is also homework, because it's helpful to know what functions are being called for. So our summary of AT&T syntax, so everything you should need to know. Biggest thing that confuses people, destination is always last. And if you see parentheses, that's a value in memory. It's not just a value. And we have this mapping, displacement base index scale, which just maps directly into your sort of Intel syntax or your logical sort of pseudo C thing. And each of these can be omitted. If you see a dollar sign, that means a constant. If you don't see a dollar sign, it probably means an address of in memory. So any questions on any of these rules? Okay. So since everyone's happy, let's go through a practice question. So here's an assembly snippet. I want you to figure out what the result values in RAX and RBX are going to be and compare your answer with your name. You are allowed to talk since I said compare your answer with your name. Have to do this in silence.
Yeah.
add some?
Onto the constant. Add something to a constant.
No, remember destination is last. Okay. Okay, who has an answer? Who doesn't have an answer? So who thinks it's A? A couple people. Who thinks it's B? More people. Who thinks it's C? A couple. D? One. E? Okay. A couple people think it's E. F? And one volunteer for F. Okay. Anyone want to explain their answer, whatever it is? Okay.
Yeah, I think probably it's A, but it could be wrong.
Okay. Why do you think it's A? Could you?
Yeah. So first you push one and two numbers, the two numbers onto the stack.
Yeah.
And then one is above two because two is pushed later.
Mm-hmm.
And then you add three onto RSP. RSP is pointing at two first.
Yeah.
And then you offset it with eight bits.
Eight bytes,
which means it goes to the next number, which is one, and then you add three onto one, which is four and two, and then you pop REX with two, and then pop RDX with four, so REX is two, and RDX is four, so it's eight.
Yeah, so exactly. So this eight RSP is the next value on the stack, since this is something which also gets people, is that the stack pointer always points to something that is actually on the stack. So 0 plus RSP is always a value on the stack, in this case the most recently pushed. So 8 plus 8 is 64 bits later, so it's the next value. Yes?
Does that mean
that the stack pointer is always pointing to the last push item? Yes, so the stack pointer points to the last push value. It points to a valid value on the stack. Yes? The push will shift the stack pointer. It has two effects. First, it changes the stack pointer, and then it writes to that changed location. Yes?
Didn't you say that the stack grows downward, though?
Yes.
So if the stack is growing downwards, if you add 8, what if that...
So it grows towards lower addresses. So adding 8, it goes to a higher address, so something that is less recently on the stack. Are there questions, confusion, comments? Yes?
Can you explain that 8 thing
again with the byte share? So Q means an 8-byte value, a 64-bit value. And adding 8 to RSP skips 64 bits on the stack. So it skips this last push worth. So if we somehow could push a 32-bit value, we want 4 instead, and so on. So, other questions, comments about this? People still confused, happy? Okay. So, this is our crash course on assembly, which should be enough to get you started on the lab tomorrow and the homework that follows. And we're talking about AT&T syntax because we're going to use it for the rest of the course. And our textbook uses it, so you better be able to read it. We'll review some assembly some more later, probably next week, including talking about how branching and loops work, which maybe you technically saw in 2150, but our experience is that people didn't really remember it or didn't see it, and labels and condition codes. Things that you'll actually need to know since you'll be implementing a CPU, and it would be very good to be able to actually run code with branches and loops. So, any more questions on assembly? No? Okay. So, if there's no more questions on assembly stuff, we'll move on to a little bit of C. So first of all, I'd like to talk about data types in C. You've probably seen data types in C++. They vary between machines. I just do. For this course, we'll be talking about the sizes of things, except when we specify otherwise, on our lab machines, which run 64-bit Linux. So there, chars are 1 byte, shorts are 2, ints are 4, and longs are 8. It's just what they've chosen. We also have some other types that you may have used, like float and double. Float happens to be 4 on our lab machines. Double happens to be 8. This is another thing which might vary between different machines. And the other important type we'll be dealing with are pointer types. And since our lab machines are 64-bit, pointers are 64-bit, that's usually what people are referring to when they say a system is 32 or 64-bit, is the size of pointers. So pointers, all kinds of pointers, are 8 bytes. Any questions on these sizes? Okay, so let's talk about some things which are different in C than C++, and one of those things is truth. So in C++, you have a bool type. There is no bool type in C. So you might wonder, what happens when I compare, say, x to 4? I get a result. I can use that in comparison. Well, that returns an int. And it's 1 if it's true and 0 if it's false. This is what C has chosen to do since they don't have a Boolean type. And so basically, you can use any value in C in an if statement or a while loop, and it's either true or false. And here is the exhaustive list of false values in C. 0 is false. This includes pointers, so a null pointer is 0 cast to a pointer. That is also false. All other values are true. Negative numbers, they're true. Pointers to things which aren't null, true. Okay. Any questions on this? Yeah.
Wait, so when you check logic, it only returns 1 or 0. But any other.
Yeah, so the logic returns 1 or 0, but it would produce the correct result in an if statement if it returned 200 or 0. And you might see C code which takes advantage of this in the wild. Okay. So in C++, you probably use like a string class or something, I assume, or that's typical. Strings in C are a bit different. So here's us declaring a pointer hello, which points to a string. And the way that works is that hello, it's a pointer to a char. It doesn't point to multiple things. So this hello pointer, which is on the stack or in a register because it's a local variable, points to the first letter of this string. And after that letter in memory is the rest of the string, and it's terminated with a \0, which just represents 0 cast to a char. And this is somewhere in the read-only data part of the program, because we just took a constant string and got a pointer to it. And you can access different parts of that string using pointer arithmetic. So if I want to access this space here, I can add 5 to my pointer. I can treat my pointer kind of like it's a number. And, well, really it is a number in the machine. And we can just add 5 to it and get a pointer to the space. It's 5 because that advances by 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 spaces. And basically, this does the same thing as adding 5 to the raw pointer value. And this result of adding 5 is still a pointer, so we can dereference it, just like we dereference a normal pointer, and get back the space, or we could try to write to the space, except that this is read-only data, and that's not allowed. And there's another syntax that you probably have seen for doing this, which is the square brackets. So you're used to this being how you index arrays and things like that. It turns out that this is exactly the same. So this hello bracket 0 is just shorthand for hello plus 0 in parentheses dereferenced. This is how things always work in C. So same here with hello 5 here. They're exactly the same. And I know that you might not believe they're really exactly the same, because in C++, they aren't. In particular, vectors in C++, they do very different things if you try these two things. If you add to a vector, not much good happens. But in C, these are really exactly the same as each other, even cases which you think wouldn't make sense. And this works even for normal arrays. So if I declare an array and not a pointer, and I try to do arithmetic on it, or other things which treat it like a pointer, it's going to decay into a pointer. It's going to implicitly convert to a pointer to its first element. So any questions on this? This or how strings are represented? Yes?
What happens when you dereference the backcast 0?
You get a char 0 cast to a char. This is a perfectly valid value. Yes?
Is there any way to make an actual array of characters to where you could do it?
So yes. Yes, there is. There will be an example on the next slide. Other questions? Yeah?
So if you called hello and then hello.size or whatever, would you get back 0?
So we'll probably talk about that next time. So there's no dot size on a pointer. If you try to query the size of hello, what is it declared as? It's constant char star. So we can go back to this table I showed you earlier, and you can look up on the table what the size of that is.
Yeah, but if you had a string that was just an empty string, but it was initialized to whatever memory value, and you called that memory value, would you get returned the 0, since you said that the backslash 0 was just 0 as a character?
So that's the character 0. That's not a size. So if you want to know how long the string is, you look for the 0.
Yeah, I'm not worried about the size. I'm just worried about if you go out of bounds trying to retrieve something from a C string.
Okay. So your question is, so I can add 5. What happens if I add 20? Is that your question?
Kind of, except for exactly hitting the value where the backslash 0.
So the backslash 0 is perfectly legal to read, and you will need to do that sometimes. Okay. So if you want to know how long a string of this style is, so what you do is you loop through each character until you see that backslash 0. So that is perfectly valid to do. If you want to access the thing after it, well, your compiler is not going to tell you what that's going to do. Other questions? Yeah?
Does the backslash 0 have a specific ASCII? Because I'm wondering if you limit it.
It's the ASCII value 0.
Okay. So it's still within the confines of 8 bytes?
8 bits, yeah. 8 bits. Yes, and this means that if you want to have a string which contains ASCII 0, you can't use this style of strings. Which is not true with standard string in C++. You can't actually have a backslash 0 in a standard string, not in the C style string. Okay, other questions? So let's try a little bit of exercise. So this is how you declare an array that will be, it's just a local variable in this case, so it's going to be on the stack. rather than a pointer to constant data. And it happens to be initialized with a string, which is the same as initializing it like this. So here's some code which uses pointers and arrays, and figure out what the final value of foo is, and compare your answer with your name. I would recommend writing something down, but you don't have to. Okay, who has an answer? Who doesn't have an answer? Not many volunteers for that. Let's see, so those of you who have an answer, who thinks it's A? B? C? D? E? Okay, I think we have rough consensus. It turns out C is correct. And rather than asking someone, I will go through a brief explanation because I have pictures. So we have foo, which because of this syntax where we're specifying it's an array and not a pointer, is allocated on the stack with space for four characters and gets initialized to the string. And we have pointer, which is set to foo. And arrays are going to decay into pointers to their first element. So this will make pointer point to that f, the first character of foo. And then we dereference the pointer and change that character to a b. Then we do some pointer arithmetic and increment the pointer by 2. So it now points to the third character of the array. And we set that using this syntax, which remember it's equivalent to parentheses pointer plus zero dereferenced. So you could also write it as just star pointer equals z. And I would recommend doing that for people reading your code. But these are both equivalent. And this sets the last character of the string to z. And then we use the alternate syntax for foo index 1 equals a, which is taking foo adding 1, so getting a pointer to the second element and dereferencing that and setting that to a. And that's how the string gets set to bas. Yeah?
So we would say that the value of foo is bas, even though there's a null character.
So it's the string bas, because strings in C have a null character at the end.
Oh, okay.
It's usually how I would say it.
You had to declare it with an extra character at the beginning, like you declared four letters.
That's why I have four letters, yes, because to have space for that null character.
And you always have to do that?
Yeah, so it turns out you could omit the number entirely, in which case the compiler will look at the size of this and figure that out for you. But if you specify the number, you should include the null character. If you don't, it will allocate enough space, it will allocate the amount of space you say and truncate it, which will be very confusing, because if you pass a pointer to foo to something which expects a null character, it might not be there. Yeah?
So what if we modify the slash zero?
So if you modify the slash zero, that is, modifying this slash zero here is not an error. However, you might say pass this to a function that output the string. And a typical C function to output a string is going to expect to find a slash zero. And it's not going to find it, so it's going to look past the end of whatever's after the string on the stack, and that's going to do something very weird. But changing the slash zero itself is not technically wrong. It's when you use the array after doing that as a string. So other questions on this? So I showed you this equivalence here, that this array indexing is the same as pointer arithmetic. And all my examples have been with care stars, where pointer arithmetic means just you're adding to the pointer. And you might say, well, how does that work if I don't have an array of single byte things? I can't add one to the address of an int and get the next int in an array. Is this still equivalent? And the answer is yes. And the reason that still works is that pointer arithmetic, this plus operation, is dependent on the size of the pointer to type. So if we have, say, an array of integers that are 4 bytes long in the system we care about, and you get a pointer to them, this operation of adding 2 to the pointer is not going to add 2 to the address. It's going to add 8. And the C compiler knows to add 8 because it looks at your declaration of the pointer, and it sees it's an int pointer. And it knows how big ints are, and it just automatically multiplies whatever you're adding by the size of the thing it points to, in this case, 4. So in this way, other types of arrays work too. So this means that this code basically is the same sort of idea as what you saw before, just with ints, and it works with, if you think about array indices. So one way you can always think about pointer arithmetic is imagine the thing being pointed to as a big array of whatever the type being pointed to is, and think of pointer arithmetic as just moving in that array. The compiler is responsible for adjusting how much you add or subtract from the addresses to account for the size of the elements of the array. So any questions about this? So, any other questions about today? So, next time I'm going to go into a little more on arrays versus pointers. I'm keeping us in sync with the other class section. That's that's happening. And also into other things about C that are different from C++. And if you have any questions.